We are in Ephesians 4 this morning in verse 11. Let me read the verse. And he gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers. Now the verse sounds simple enough, but this verse required a lot of study for me. So I did another topic for a while to give me time to ponder this passage. The subject is that when Jesus ascended to heaven, he gave gifts to men. And some became apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers. The question is this: how are we to take these gifts? My greatest difficulty was in seeking to identify who the prophets are. Today we have a movement called the NAR. Anybody know or familiar with that? NAR. The New Apostolic Reformation. That's the NAR. The internet site godquestions.org says this: the New Apostolic Reformation teaches that God's intended form of church governance is apostles and prophets holding leadership over evangelists, pastors, and teachers. In our passage, we see some of the reasoning for this position. 1 Corinthians 12:28 says, "And God has appointed these in the church, first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, etc." So apostles are first, prophets second, and there we have the foundation of the NAR. My main question was this: who are these prophets? The apostles seemed simple enough. The more work I did, the more I was pushed to try to go back to the original setting. We come to this a question like we have here, thinking that church back then was like we have it today. We come to such a question with the whole New Testament before us. But when Paul wrote this letter to the Ephesians, they did not have the New Testament. Some of the New Testament books would have been written at this time, but they would not have known that they were inspired books of the Bible, and likely would not have had access to them either. Very few churches would have had more than one or two books, if any. Very few were agreed which books should go in. It is very doubtful that any who were converted would have had access to any Old Testament or New Testament books. See, we take all this for granted. That's not how it was. Think of it. Before Paul wrote this letter to the Ephesians, there was no New Testament book called the Ephesians. So here's the question I ask myself: how did these Ephesian Christians understand what Paul meant by prophets when they got the letter? Well, Paul stopped in Ephesus briefly on his second missionary journey. This is about AD 50 or 52. This church likely had its early beginnings there. Then on Paul's third missionary journey, about AD 53 through 58, he stayed there for almost 3 years. So clearly they got a lot of teaching at this time. The church at Corinth and the church at Ephesus had their beginnings about the same time. And the church at Ephesus had, this is important to our discussion because we must seek to understand how the Ephesian readers would have understood what Paul meant by apostles and prophets, etc. By the way, as I was studying, I came across this you might find interesting regarding the history of the Ephesian church. It gives seven pictures of the church. Picture one, sprouting, AD 52. Picture two, weeding, AD 54 through 56. Picture three, nurturing, AD 57. Picture four, watering, AD 62. Picture five, producing, AD 66. Picture six, wilting, AD 96. Picture seven, dead. That's sobering, isn't it? Well, in our studies in Ephesians 4, Paul has encouraged the Ephesians to unity, and now he will show them God's method of maintaining unity. We find this in Ephesians 4, 11 through 16. He has pictured the church as a body, and a body has various members that have been endowed with special abilities or gifts. And in the same way, a church needs various members with special abilities or gifts. So we want to look at God's method of maintaining the unity of the body. We begin with verse 11, the divine provision, which is spiritual gifts or gifted people. But we'll begin by reading verses 11 through 16. Paul says this, and he gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, that we should no longer be children tossed to and fro, carried about with every wind of doctrine by the trickery of men in the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting. But speaking the truth in love, may grow up in all things into him who is the head, Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. So Paul begins with listing some gifts, or should I say gifted people, in verse 11. Here is the divine provision for unity in the church. In this message, I want to seek to explain the first two gifts, apostles and prophets. I did not expect this verse would be so taxing in study. When you look at verse 11, it looks simple enough, but even D. Martin Lloyd-Jones struggled to explain it. He listed these gifts in two groups, gifts that were for the early church and gifts that are for all time. So he viewed apostles and prophets and evangelists as those for the early church. He viewed evangelists not being such as we would call evangelists in modern times. Then pastors and teachers he viewed as those gifts in use after the church was established. I want to propose that Paul here very carefully enumerates these gifts as those most crucial for the founding of the church, and then its ongoing operation. You most certainly need not agree with my conclusions. It is a most difficult verse. At the outset, let me say that I believe that the apostles referred to are the 12 apostles. The term apostle is only used for the apostles of Jesus Christ. One time, Jesus Christ is referred to in Hebrews 3:1 as the apostle and high priest of our profession. One time, reference is made to false apostles. Otherwise, only the 12 are mentioned. Now, let me mention here that Bible scholars have set out certain criteria that a person has to meet to qualify as an apostle of Jesus Christ. I don't want to take much time on this, but let me mention what is usually given. First, to qualify as an apostle, one must have seen the Lord. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9:1, am I not an apostle? Am I not free? Have I not seen Jesus Christ the Lord? So I give these because if this is correct, the NAR is totally wrong. The second is that an apostle had to be commissioned by the Lord himself. Third, he needed to have been given a supernatural revelation of truth. The fourth is that he was given infallibility. Fifth, he had the power to work miracles. Well, I have not had the interest to study that in any depth. But if even only the first one is true, the NAR has the wrong system of church government. And I have no question, it's totally on a wrong foundation. The NAR is the New Apostolic Reformation, and I understand it is one of the fastest growing so-called Christian movements today. Well, the office of apostleship is not an ongoing office. It came to a close with the 12 apostles. The difficulty now is, what is meant by prophets in our verse? And I see four possibilities. Let me give and explain each one as we go along. First, it could refer to the Old Testament prophets. Turn to Ephesians chapter 2, verses 19 through 20. Ephesians Paul says, now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens and with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. These apostles and prophets are the foundation of the church. This gives them both a very, very important and significant position. But I do not think the reference is to Old Testament prophets. I covered the reasons for that when we went through those verses. But look at chapter 3, verse 5 now in Ephesians. The context speaks of the church, and verse 5 says, of the church, which in other ages was not made known to the sons of men, as it has now been revealed to by the Spirit to his holy apostles and prophets. The church was not made known to the Old Testament prophets, so it cannot refer to them. Turn now to Acts 21. There was a man by name of Agabus, and he prophesied in Acts chapter 11 of a famine that was coming, and it did. Then in Acts 21, verses 10 through 11, we have this account. And as we stayed many days, a certain prophet named Agabus came down from Judea. When he had come to us, he took Paul's belt, bound his own hands and feet, and said, thus says the Holy Spirit, so shall the Jews at Jerusalem bind the man who owns this belt and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles. So here we have a prophet who prophesied the future, and it happens. But yet again, I do not see how this type of prophet was anywhere near important enough to qualify as that on which the church was built. Turn now to 1 Corinthians 14. The third kind of prophet this might speak of is the kind of prophet who spoke to Christians to edify, exhort, or comfort them. It would be the same thing preachers today do. So look at verses 1 through 4. Pursue love and desire spiritual gifts, but especially that you may prophesy. For he who speaks in a tongue does not speak to men, but to God, for no one understands him. However, in the Spirit he speaks mysteries. But he who prophesies speaks edification and exhortation and comfort to men. He who speaks in a tongue edifies himself, but he who prophesies edifies the church. It is here I want to spend some time, because to understand this part of church history is helpful to our subject, because the time is much the same. And then we'll look at the fourth kind of prophet. Well, as I pondered this, I came to the conclusion that this list of gifts must be understood in a way that the church at Ephesus would have understood it when Paul wrote to them. As I pondered that, I pondered how they had church back then. Now, it is most natural for us to think they had church like this. They didn't. So let me ask you, how do you think they had church? Think of this. This letter was written around AD 61 to 63. From the time the church was born in Acts 2 until this time of writing of the letter of Ephesians is about 30 years. What do you think their church services were like? Turn to Acts chapter 2. I want to show you the first church services. We find them in Acts chapter 2, and we find how they met. We begin in Acts chapter 2, verse 41. This is the first day, the brand new church, and then it talks about how they worked from there. Then they that gladly received his word were baptized, and the same day there were added to them about 3,000 souls. And they continued, I'm reading Old King James here, I see. And they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship and in breaking of bread and in prayers. And fear came upon every soul, and many wonders and signs were done by the apostles. And all that believed were together and had all things common, and sold their possessions and goods and parted them to all men as every man had need. And they continued daily with one accord in the temple and breaking bread from house to house, did eat their meat with gladness and singleness of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people, and the Lord added to the church daily such as should be saved. Now note in verse 40 that Peter encourages the listeners to be saved from this perverse generation. He's talking about the Jewish people of that day. He is preaching at the temple. About 3,000 people were saved and were added, verse 41, added to the church, the called out ones. And what did they do? Well, they were baptized. Here's the outward rite that showed they were now identified with Christ. I am amazed that huge persecution didn't follow right here, but it didn't seem to. It says they had favor with all the people. There were no church buildings. There was no place of gathering except the temple, and they continued to go there, but they were now followers of Jesus Christ, and those who went to the temple were not followers of Jesus Christ. So what did they do for fellowship? Well, verse 42, and they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship and in breaking of bread and in prayers. They did this from house to house. Verse 46 says they went from house to house. They had a church from house to house where they practiced those things that pertain to them now as followers of Christ and not as the Jews who didn't believe. So we have a mixed worship. They went to the temple and to their Christian gathering where they continued in the teaching of the apostles. And here they fellowshipped as believers. They had communion. I think they had communion every week. And they prayed together. Part of their church life was praying together. Now, here is what we must realize. In those early days, none of those who became Christians had a Bible. We just don't think like that. But they did not have a Bible. So their main source of spiritual food was the teaching of the apostles. You can imagine from this that no new convert would have wanted to miss a gathering. I expect they might have informed each other where the next meeting would take place, and they'd meet at another house the next time. So the education of these early Christians centered around the teaching of the apostles. The apostles would have recounted the things they learned from Jesus, and they would have told and retold the stories of their experiences of Christ. The picture is this. They had no Bible. There was no New Testament. They were dependent on their knowledge of the reading of the Old Testament scrolls in the synagogue or at the temple of the Old Testament teaching. And they were dependent on the disciples for the teachings of Christ. No New Testament. Most of them, if any of them, probably none of them, would have had any of the scriptures themselves other than what they had learned. So for them, as a church, everything is brand new. Well, we go from there. After this early time, persecution began to set in as people left Judaism and became Christians. And more Judaism and believers in Christ were separated. Then Herod, the son of Herod the Great, who also killed John the Baptist, entered the persecution of Christianity. When he saw it pleased the Jews that he persecuted the Christians, he persecuted even more. So because of this persecution, believers were now pushed out beyond Jerusalem. The first Christian church to be established outside of Jerusalem, anybody know? Where were people first called Christians? Antioch. The Christians in these new places could no longer go to the temple. You see? How did they have church now? In their house meetings, they likely had no Old Testament books nor any New Testament books at this early stage. They were dependent on those who knew the Old Testament and those who had been with Jesus or who had been with those who had been with Jesus. That is all they had. Many cities at that time had synagogues, so they could go to the synagogue, which some may have done, but they would have had their own services where they would commemorate the resurrection. This was an important part of the early church service, and would not have been welcome in a synagogue. Somewhere here, they would have begun to have church in a place set up for that, but I don't know where. Well, we now go to a New Testament example of a church at this time. We go to 1 Corinthians. This is a carnal or fleshly church filled with pride and divisions about gifts and numerous other things. But in chapter 14, we get some idea of how they met and did church. Now, the issue dealt with in particular in 1 Corinthians 12, 13, 14, anybody know? What's the issue? It is speaking in tongues. Today we have divisions about this subject in charismatic circles. The Southern Baptist churches are seeing great movements of this phenomena in their churches today. The NAR is largely a charismatic movement. We are not going to deal with the subject of tongues. I have a booklet on speaking in tongues if anyone wishes to study this subject. What we want to look at briefly is how they had their services or how Paul instructs them to run their services. Now, my interest here is how they had their services and in particular the role of the prophet. In chapter 11, verse 18, in this book, Paul said, "For first of all, when you come together as a church," here we have their church meetings, "I hear that there are divisions among you, and in part, I believe it." In chapter 11, he deals with their problems at communion. Well, first the head covering, and then communion, which was a big part of early church worship. In chapter 12, Paul deals with the problems they experienced regarding gifts. But he says there is a more important matter. And anybody know what that a more important matter was? Chapter 13, what's the subject there? Love. Love. So he deals with that in chapter 13, and then he begins chapter 14 like this. "Pursue love and desire spiritual gifts, but especially that you may prophesy." Here we have prophets. So that's the our interest here. Those who prophesy are prophets. Verse 2. Now listen to what a prophet is. "For he who speaks in a tongue does not speak to men but to God, for no one understands him. However, in the spirit he speaks mysteries. But he who prophesies speaks edification and exhortation and comfort to men." Let me just say this, that I understand speaking in tongues to mean speaking in foreign languages. I can't deal with that here. Again, I have all this in the booklet I mentioned for those who might wish it. I can email that to you. But in verse 3, we now have a clear explanation of what Paul means when he speaks of a prophet. It is one who speaks edification and exhortation and comfort to men. So prophets are of two kinds. You can remember them like this. The one type of prophet foretells the future. Some of those are given in the book of Acts. The other type does not foretell, but forthtells. So there's the foretelling and the forthtelling prophet. That is, he speaks edification, exhortation, or comfort to men. That is what we today would call a preacher or a pastor. In the early church, they were called prophets. Look now at verse 4. "He who speaks in a tongue edifies himself, but he who prophesies edifies the church." Then he says, "I wish you all spoke with tongues." I understand this to mean foreign languages. "But even more that you prophesied. For he who prophesies is greater than he who speaks with tongue, unless indeed he interprets, that the church may receive edification." Let me just briefly explain or comment. Why is the preacher or the prophet greater than the one who speaks in tongues? The prophet speaks the same thing as the one who speaks in tongues, only he does it in a language that is understood by the people present. The message of the one who speaks in a tongue is understood either by only a few people, or if it is an unknown tongue, nobody present understands. To edify, the language must first be interpreted. So in verse 5, if the one who speaks in a foreign language can interpret into the common language, now he is just as great as the prophet. Why? Because now he's understood. Let me just mention Corinth was a seaport city and had people of many different nationalities and languages present in their services. That is what caused the need to speak in various languages, and that is why it was not to be done unless there was an interpreter. Verse 6, but now, brethren, if I come to you speaking with tongues, what shall I profit you unless I speak to you either by revelation, by knowledge, by prophesying, or by teaching? So then Paul takes some time to show that if one speaks in a language not understood by the rest, that it has no benefit as far as edification is concerned. We pick up in verse 23. Therefore, if the whole church comes together in one place and all speak with tongues and there come in those who are uninformed or unbelievers, will they not say that you are out of your mind? But if all prophesy and an unbeliever or an uninformed person comes in, he is convinced by all and he is convicted by all. And thus the secrets of his heart are revealed, and so falling down on his face, he will worship God and report that God is truly among you. So we now come to an important aspect of early church meetings. Remember, they have no Old Testament present, and not likely was there any New Testament book present. So they learn from each other. In light of that understanding, look at verse 26. How is it then, brethren, whenever you come together, each of you has a psalm, has a teaching, has a tongue, has a revelation, has an interpretation. Let all things be done for edification. What I understand this to say is that when they gather, one person has a psalm they know. How valuable would that be if you have no Bible present? Somebody knows a psalm by memory. Then one has a biblical teaching that would be useful to the Christians. Another has a tongue. So there is someone present who does not understand a certain teaching because they don't know much of the common language. And there is another who has the ability to translate for him, so he has a tongue. Another has a revelation. I would understand this not as a divine revelation in the sense of something we would put on par with Scripture. But let us say in a service like this, where they are sharing various things with each other, another sitting by all of a sudden realizes how this applies or how it fits with something else. And it is a revelation to him, and he can share this with the others now. Remember, this is their teaching time. They have no Bibles present. Then it says, another has an interpretation. Now, I think the interpretation intended here is not from one language to another, although that may be there as well, but the application or the interpretation of some spiritual truth from a certain passage, it's called interpretation. This is what I am seeking to do right now, to interpret what is the meaning of prophets in a passage. And last note, what the overriding principle is that Paul gives here, let all things be done decently and in order. Have you ever seen movements like the Toronto Blessing? Is it decently and in order? Now note how Paul instructs tongue speaking and prophets to keep things in order. We go to verse 27. If anyone speaks in a tongue, let there be two or at the most three, each in turn, and let one interpret. But if there is no interpreter, let him keep silent in the church and let him speak to himself and to God. Let me just mention something here. If tongues are not languages, you do not know if you have an interpreter present. You follow that? If tongues are not languages, you do not know if you have an interpreter present. Now note whom Paul calls prophets in the church, verse 29. Let two or three prophets speak and let the others judge. But if anything is revealed to another who sits by, let the first keep silent. For you can all prophesy one by one, that all may learn and all may be encouraged. Now note, he did not say you may all prophesy one by one. He says you can, You have the ability. Here's what that means. A prophet, one who had the ability, was allowed to prophesy. If you had the ability, you were allowed to do it. In chapter 12, Paul says, do all prophesy? What is the answer? No. So not all are prophets. But in a congregation like this, those that were prophets, that is, they could speak to others to edification, exhortation, and comfort, these were all allowed to speak, but it must be one by one. Verse 32. And the spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets, for God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. By the way, let me just remind you, we're talking about the early church where they don't have a Bible present. This is how they learned. That's the only way they could learn. Verse 32 is important here. When someone must speak or they are not in control of themselves, we're talking about the Toronto blessing, you know one thing, not God. Not God. Verse 34, let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive, as the law also says, and I would take this in view of the prophets. And if they want to learn something, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it is shameful for women to speak in the church. Or did the word of God come originally from you, or was it you only that it reached? If anyone thinks himself to be a prophet or spiritual, let him acknowledge that the things which I write to you are the commandments of the Lord. But if anyone is ignorant, let him be ignorant. Therefore, brethren, desire earnestly to prophesy, and do not forbid to speak with tongues. Let all things be done decently and in order. So, the type of prophet we have here is one who speaks in the church to others to edification, exhortation, and comfort. This is not foretelling the future. Once again, remember that they did not have the Old Testament present in their services, nor the New Testament. They depended on those who had some knowledge from the apostles or those who had learned from the apostles. So let me ask you a question. Anybody know how long it was from when Christ left or the first New Testament books were written until they were recognized in the church? All of them were recognized as inspired?
150
years? No more. Between 300 and 400 years. Up until then, they were James shouldn't be in the Bible. Revelation shouldn't be in the Bible. This book shouldn't be in. So they were divided up until that time. So what we must remember, we're not talking about a church situation like we have it here. So now I give this to give us some idea of how different church was in these early days. And again, I do not think that the kind of prophet mentioned here is what Paul has in mind in our passage. The prophet Paul has in mind, I think, is one who, along with the apostles, makes up the foundation of the church, as he has already mentioned to these Ephesians to whom he is now writing. Today there are all kinds of movements around, all kinds. Listen, the Bible has been completed for a long time. There are no new biblical prophets. There's nothing to be added to the Bible. In Corinth, there was carnality among the prophets, as is evidenced by 1 Corinthians 14, so I don't think that these are the foundation of the church. So note once more the prophets in Ephesians. Let me read 2:19 through 20. Now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being joined together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. The foundation of the universal church rests upon these prophets. Now listen to Ephesians 3, 1 through 5. For this reason, I, Paul, the prisoner of Christ Jesus for you Gentiles, If indeed you have heard of the dispensation of the grace of God, which was given to me for you, how that by revelation he made known to me the mystery, as I have briefly written already, by which when you read you may understand my knowledge in the mystery of Christ, which in other ages was not made known to the sons of men, as it has now been revealed by the Spirit to his holy apostles and prophets. The mystery of the church was revealed to the Lord's holy apostles and prophets. I believe the apostles and prophets spoken of here are those to whom God revealed his word in what we now have as New Testament books. Go to Acts chapter 15. Paul and Barnabas had run into trouble in their mission work. Jews were converted among the Gentiles, and they insisted that Gentiles needed to be circumcised and keep the Jewish laws like the Jews did. And Paul and Barnabas went to Jerusalem to work this out with the apostles. And after they concluded on this, verse 32, chapter 15, says, "And Judas and Silas, being prophets also themselves, exhorted the brethren with many words and confirmed them." When it says Judas and Silas were also prophets, that means as well as Paul and Barnabas. I'm using this to show that Paul was considered to be a prophet. So the prophets in the churches, and we note in 1 Corinthians 14 that they are called pastors, or they are not called pastors in that chapter, got their information from the apostles or those who had been with the apostles or had been with Jesus. That is, those who propagated the teachings of the apostles and prophets were also called prophets. When we come to Ephesians, they are referred to as pastors and teachers, no longer prophets. Listen to Ellicott's commentary on our passage in Ephesians. He writes, "It is sufficient here to note, one, that from very early times the prophets are mentioned as a separate class, distinguished from teachers, and that in this epistle especially they are spoken of in connection with the apostles as receiving the revealed mystery of the gospel and being the foundation of the church, that their office, like the apostolate, is clearly extraordinary, distinct from the ordinary and permanent teaching of the evangelists and pastors, and probably best described by the two phrases so constantly applied to the prophets of the Old Testament: the word of the Lord came to me, or the Spirit of the Lord was upon me," end quote. I think it is this that explains the use of apostles and prophets in our text. The apostles would refer to the 12 apostles, and the prophets are those who received the word of God and wrote it down, but they were not necessarily apostles. Can you name a writer of a New Testament book who was not an apostle? Can you name a gospel that was not written by an apostle? Matthew was an apostle. Luke was not. Luke was a Gentile, I understand. Mark wasn't an apostle. But they wrote gospels. What's that? The apostles were all Jews, but Luke was not an apostle, and he was not a Jew, I understand. So Paul would be both an apostle and a prophet. Not many apostles wrote books that went into the New Testament. Only a few did. So let me give you the writers of the New Testament who were apostles and those who were not and would be prophets, that is, who wrote books. Of the apostles, Matthew wrote one book. Anybody know how many books John wrote? Five. John wrote five books. And Peter wrote how many? Two. Paul wrote how many? Oh, it's okay. You won't know. I didn't know either. 13. For a total of 21. If the prophets who make up the foundation of the church are writers of the New Testament books, those who wrote but were not apostles are James, one book, Luke, two books, Jude, one book, and Mark, one book. And we do not know who wrote Hebrews. This is for a total of six. Two gospels were written by apostles and two by non-apostles, but they were prophets. So let me read Ephesians 2:19 through 20 once more. Now, therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. So without the whole New Testament, you don't have a foundation. You don't have a complete foundation. When it speaks of the church universal being built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, it is these writers of the New Testament books, for surely the church rests on these books. So when Paul says God gave some apostles and some prophets, I believe he is speaking of those who became the foundation of the church. Jesus Christ is the chief cornerstone, and all Christians are built up a spiritual house on that foundation. Now, though I have mentioned it before, today it is important that we understand this in light of the modern movement called the NAR. When you read our verse in Ephesians and you look at what they believe, you will understand where they get their understanding from. So let me read what I gave when we were in Ephesians 2. I said, the NAR is largely associated with Pentecostal churches. It has thousands of churches and millions of believers, according to godquestions.org. Now let me read what they write about this movement. It will be helpful for you to know. By the way, I have a nephew involved in this. Might be more, I don't know. He says here, the New Apostolic Reformation teaches that God's intended form of church governance is apostles and prophets holding leadership over evangelists, pastors, and teachers. However, this has not been the case for the vast majority of Christian history. So according to the New Apostolic Reformation, God began to restore prophets and apostles over the last 30 or 40 years. Only now, as the church is properly guided by the appropriate spiritual leaders, can it fulfill its commission. This commission is seen as more than spiritual, as it includes cultural and political control. In the New Apostolic Reformation, apostles are seen as the highest of all spiritual leaders, being specially empowered by God. True maturity and unity per the New Apostolic Reformation is only found in those who submit to the leadership of their apostles. According to this teaching, as the church unifies behind the apostles, these leaders will develop greater and greater supernatural powers. Eventually, this will include the ability to perform mass healings and suspend the laws of physics. These signs are meant to encourage a massive wave of converts to Christianity. These apostles are also destined to be recipients of a great wealth transfer in the end times, which will enable the church to establish God's kingdom on earth. You can tell where this stuff is going, right? Prophets in the Neo-Apostolic Reformation are almost as important as apostles. These people have been empowered to receive new revelations from God that will aid the church in establishing dominion. According to the Neo-Apostolic Reformation, only prophets and occasionally apostles can obtain new revelations. Evangelists, pastors, and teachers cannot. The prophets' new revelations are crucial to overcoming the world, and the success of the church depends on the apostles following through on the information prophets provide. Most of their prophecies are extremely vague and easy to interpret. The New Apostolic Reformation is willing to modify them since they set no standard of infallibility for themselves. According to the New Apostolic thinking, mankind lost its dominion over earth as part of the fall of Adam. So Jesus' sacrifice on the cross not only resolved our sin debt, but it empowered mankind, specifically Christians, to retake control of the earth. You can just tell where this all is going. The New Apostolic Reformation sees seven areas in which believers are supposedly empowered and expected to dominate. Number one, government. Two, arts. Three, finances, education, religion, family, and media. Of these, the New Apostolic Reformation sees government as the most important because of its ability to influence all of the other facets of life. As a result, the New Apostolic Reformation overtly encourages Christian control over politics, culture, and business. In some ways, this is nothing unusual, as people should be expected to vote and lobby according to their convictions. The New Apostolic Reformation, however, is often accused of pushing for outright theocracy. Well, when I originally gave this quote, I said this: while it is important to know a little about that movement, but their understanding of apostleship is very unbiblical. Its history is wrong. Its form of church government is wrong. Its view on biblical revelation is wrong. Its view of the future is wrong. It is an unbiblical movement. So we conclude on Ephesians 4:11, which says, "And he himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers." I conclude that the apostles spoken of here are the 12 apostles and the prophets, as those who wrote New Testament books that were not necessarily apostles. Of the 12 apostles, only 4 wrote a New Testament book. Paul says in Ephesians 3:1 through 5, "For this reason, I, Paul, the prisoner of Jesus Christ for you Gentiles, if indeed you have heard of the dispensation of the grace of God which was given to me for you, how that by revelation he made known to me the mystery, as I have briefly written already, by which when you read you may understand my knowledge in the mystery of Christ, which in other ages was not made known to the sons of men, as it has now been revealed by the Spirit to his holy apostles and prophets." So God gave special revelation to the apostles and prophets, things that had not been revealed before. By the way, the NAR, you can tell from the quote I gave you, they're loose on prophecy. But when a prophet prophesies something and it does not happen, he's supposed to die. And if they want to be prophets, they should go by that. So in giving only a few of the gifts in Ephesians 4:11, Paul begins with the foundational gifts. First, no man since the writing of the New Testament, not even in the NAR, has ever equaled as an apostle or prophet, such as we have in those who are the foundation of the church. Nor is either of those offices a continual office. The papacy is a continual thing, and it's not continual either. The New Testament is complete, and we will never have another book. This is the foundation of the church. Now, these gifts are God's method of unity. We have plenty of disunity while we have these books. Imagine what it would be like if we didn't have them. So-and-so said Matthew said so-and-so, and so-and-so said Mark said so-and-so. Just imagine what it would be like. You think it's chaos now. It's beautiful now compared to if we didn't have this foundation. Here is the foundation of the church, in my understanding.